Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. With me this evening is Tony Gosling from Bristol, England. Welcome, Tony Gosling.
Hi there, George, again. Yeah, we've had an interesting day today with the European Union demanding a serious UK response on citizens' rights. Well, this is interesting. First of all, they're implying there, that is Donald Tusk, implying that the guy that nobody's ever elected, by the way, is implying that Britain is not serious. So this is immediately the kind of statements that these EU leaders are making is insulting, first of all. So they're not interested in any kind of real diplomacy. This thing of citizens' rights, well, what he's really saying is that all of those Europeans that have come in on work permits, etc., into Britain must be allowed to stay. Right, so that's effectively the ultimatum that the EU leaders are making to Theresa May. It doesn't help that we've got this snap election going on at the same time, George, because it is starting to confuse everybody as to whether the makeup of the House of Commons in a month, just over a month's time, is going to be the same as it is now. I mean, the likely Conservatives will have a majority. That is what the polls are telling us. But a lot can happen in 4 weeks in an election, general election campaign. And also there are all sorts of reasons why people might be steering away from voting Conservative, largely in that the main mass media in London is pretty much all pro-Conservative. And the British people aren't always completely convinced by what the media tells them, as we've seen, it's the same in the United States with the election of Donald Trump. You know, he wasn't the favourite, but he won. And he wasn't in the highest in the polls, but he won. And also exactly the same with the Brexit vote last year here in Britain. The polls are telling us one thing. Sometimes you get a bit of a surprise.
Yeah, are we seeing that the people are reacting to propaganda and not going for it like they used to?
Well, I think you're right. Yeah, I mean, the other thing is that these EU leaders, although they seem to come out with the right kind of statements, you know, like slightly threatening, slightly bullying, as if to say, well, you know, you've been nasty to us. Well, they're fair weather friends, aren't they? Whilst the British economy is being destroyed and the work is being taken by migrants, and British people are going on the dole. All the industries are moving out, things like steel, car making, all the major industries moving out of Britain because of European Union policies, not just because the British aren't efficient. It's just that the EU is set up to benefit the people that are most in charge running it, that is to say the Germans and to a lesser extent the French. So, you know, we're the victims of the EU. In fact, it's not just Britain that is. You look at Greece, you look at Spain, you look at Italy. Most of these countries which were strong are now weak. In contrast, the Norwegians and the Swiss who've stayed out of the European Union and the Icelandics, for example, are now doing really well. They're starting to do extremely well, in fact. But it seems like this is a kind of curse, this being part of the European Union, except if you weren't in the driving seat like the Germans and to a lesser extent the French and the Belgians are.
Right. You know, some are describing that Muslim influx into Europe as a Muslim crusade. You ever heard it described like that? Huh?
Well, look.
The Christian went into the Holy Land, now they're coming back.
Look, huh? They're coming back because Britain and the United States have been behind one of the most attacks on any part of the world since the Second World War, which is the dismemberment of the countries of the Middle East. I mean, we're talking about Libya primarily. Libya has been a major place where these jihadis have come through and been trained, etc., as well as places like Jordan and Turkey. And with the absolute destruction of countries like Syria, I mean, they're getting their act together again now. But we've had millions of refugees coming out of those areas because they cannot live in the countries they were born in. So I don't think there's any kind of, it seems like putting this onto the Islamic nations. What's happened is those nations have had the iron fist of the West smashing down on them. And so people, quite rightly, have gathered their families together and said, we've got to get out of here, otherwise we're going to be dead. Now, there is also a very, I think, really important agenda to understand, which is really a Nazi agenda. And that is that, as we saw in the Second World War, the attacks on the Jews were totally unjustified. Yes, there were some Jewish people involved in finance who were just as dodgy as everybody else. But Hitler, what Hitler did is he didn't really go for them. He went for the ordinary, humble, and often poor rabbinic communities. That is to say, the ordinary people who were followers of the Old Testament Judaism. And they were slaughtered, murdered, put in death camps and concentration camps, and they were considered to be like subhumans by the Nazis. What we're moving towards, I think, in the West is a similar attitude towards Islam. Now, all I'm saying here is that there is a consistent pattern over the decades, if not centuries, but certainly decades since the Second World War, to eradicate the real followers of these monotheistic faiths. And this will come to Christianity eventually. Of course, if you go to Egypt and Syria now, you'll find just as many attacks on Christians as there are on Muslims. And so I think that's what we're seeing. And it's very important, I think, to study what the Nazi ideology was, where it came from, etc., is they were Darwinist atheists. And they were militant secularists. So effectively, Hitler was God. There was no God. Nietzsche and Wagner were quite into all this sort of thing as well. And their ideology and their culture was, we will wipe the monotheistic faith, Judaism, Islam, maybe in future years, and then Christianity on earth. And that's, I think, what we're seeing. When we see these attacks on Muslims, blaming Muslims for fleeing from their countries, yes, of course, there are some suicide bombers, etc., but they've been trained largely with US and British money by the Saudi Arabians in Wahhabism, which is this puritanical, fanatical form of Islam, which up until World War II, George, hardly existed at all. Yes, there was a crusade back in medieval times, and quite rightly, the Muslims got together to defend their lands from these nutcases who were coming across from Britain and other parts of Europe on their crusades in medieval times, like Richard II, people like this. And of course, I think it's absolutely right. If the UN was around in those days, they would have said, yeah, you've got a right to self-defense. You know, you can defend your countries from these nutcases with their swords, saying they're wonderful Christians, and then going around killing and stabbing people and, you know, running rivers running with blood in your cities.
Right.
In those days, so yes, the word crusade is a terrible thing. You know, when a lot of Christians I know here in Bristol and other parts of England, they simply would never use that term nowadays because they know it has this horrific historical connotation.
Right. What have you, this referendum passed in Turkey. Did you notice that? And there were some ballots that were not double stamped like they're supposed to be.
Listen, I mean, that
Erdogan is taking over big time, man.
Yes, he is. Yeah. Quite obviously.
Yeah.
I mean, what's happening is, I mean, I was just hearing this the other day from someone, George, close contact of mine, that, and I would say this is actually pretty trustworthy information. He's saying that people he knows who work in NATO are saying, don't tell anything to the Turks because they're basically spying on us. So that's how solid the NATO alliance is nowadays. So, you know, there isn't any real trust between Turkey and the main NATO countries, say, for example, Britain, United States, and Germany. The French under Le Pen may leave NATO.
Yeah.
And so what we're seeing is the end of this alliance, really. And it's alliance, of course, which has run its course, set up in 1946, I think it was, just after World War II, to defend against a so-called attack from the Soviet Union, which never came. So it was, it never really had a purpose. It's now got absolutely no purpose whatsoever. And what they're doing is they're moving troops into places like Ukraine.
Yeah.
And right up to the close to the Russian border. And yet we're being told here in our press, we've got out, I mean, in the European press, oh, dangerous Putin, he's threatening, blah, blah, blah. Well, no, actually, it's us that are threatening Putin. And I think British soldiers and British generals are very much aware of the dangers of actually moving up to the Russian border and starting to threaten and take on the Russian forces, because they will not last long, George.
Yeah, you know, they've been using the NATO like a UN force, what they've been doing.
I don't think... Yeah, I mean, I can see what you're saying with regards to the Security Council, possibly, dominated by Britain and the US. But hang on a minute. I mean, the General Assembly of the UN, which really should be running the UN, of course, as you probably know, the United Nations was always set up as a topsy-turvy organisation where you've got the big military powers totally dominating. On the Security Council, precisely.
With veto power, too. Yeah.
And the General Assembly being subservient to them. Now, hang on a minute. So this is the civic society of every nation on Earth is being told what to do by China, Russia, Britain, and the United States. You know, hang on a minute. Yeah. That's just wrong. It should be the other way around, that the General Assembly will be making decisions about whether a war is necessary or not, not the Security Council. So, I mean, that seems to me to be a basic fundamental flaw when the UN was originally set up. But look, today, this business of the European leaders telling us what to do, I mean, I think we've seen a total... I suppose, exposure, really, of what the EU are really like. You know, I said earlier on about, you know, fair weather friends. That's what these people are. I mean, they're starting to prepare to put Britain on the rack. Yeah, they're dusting off their old torture instruments. And they're fair weather friends. But hang on, because all we've had from the European Union, really, is dark clouds and gloom and doom from Brussels. There's been a total economic failure. This was supposed to be a wonderful, you know, glorious coming together of all these European countries, which was going to be a roaring success. Actually, the European Central Bank and the euro and the way the economies have been run in Europe has been a total and utter failure, a total and utter disaster. It's left Spain with something like 50% young people unemployed.
Man, now, that's bad. God.
I mean, absolutely crazy, George, isn't it?
Yes,
and
the only reason
they're coming to Britain is because they cannot find work in their own countries. We get a lot of Spanish people here, and I see nothing against that. But what it's saying is that the only reason that Britain has managed to carry on survive within the EU is because we've kept the pound, because we've kept some
exactly control. That monetary control saved you. It saved y'all. Saved
done,
Britain.
I would go so far as to say that Britain took a really historic decision when it came to Brexit. I mean, as historic as Winston Churchill in 1939. You know, our finest hour and all that. You know, saying, well, actually, we are going to take the Nazis on. Someone's got to do it. We're going to do it. Now, admittedly, I think there was a bit of a...
Right. Well, you know, you dropped out on me for a second.
Because Stalin and Hitler had got together. They planned the invasion. Hitler planned the invasion of Poland together, and you know, in a way, it was a kind of setup. But you know, it was a really important decision that Britain made. I think it's also, I spoke to Jacob Wallenberg at Bilderberg back last June in Dresden. I also spoke to James A. Johnson from Goldman Sachs at Bilderberg. When I mentioned the word Brexit to these people, they looked at me as if. They were almost either frightened, scared, angry. They hated the word. And I just got this amazing body language from them. They can't stand to hear the word. That's how arrogant these super elite people are. Nobody would dare mention the word in them. It's a bit like mentioning the name of Princess Diana in front of Prince Charles. He doesn't want you to mention it. And if you do, he'll never speak to you again. You know, so that's the sort of attitude these elite have. They have decided the way things are going to be, and nobody can touch them because they're so rich, they buy their way into the... So that's how important, I think, Brexit was. What Brexit has done, the vote, the majority in favour of leaving the European Union, is send a very, very clear message. And actually, some of the leaders of the EU, as it was actually happening, the vote last year, have said that this really does signal the end of this. So I'm rather proud that Britain has, the British people and the referendum have actually made that signal. I'm not sure whether it happened, George, even though there's been a referendum, because this general election that's coming along may actually put a spanner in the works for Brexit.
Right. What I was mentioning earlier is on the Le Pen-Macron thing, it was a fixed election. The results, when they closed the polls, were the same as the end of the night on the final results. They didn't change. I mean, they didn't change at all, not 0.1%. So they want Macron in there. Of course, he's the Rothschild candidate. And Le Pen, I think, is in there just as a... going to be to cathex the bad energy and the negativism of her followers to let it out, let it go. Well, you had your chance and you got beat, you know, or something like that.
But yeah, I mean, yeah. So we've, I mean, with
they're playing games, see, with it.
Yes,
playing
of course
games.
They are. Look, Britain has had its opportunity. Britain has had its chance. Its last gasp of democracy. The Greeks, back in 2015, had an opportunity to vote. They voted. They've never had the opportunity to vote, do you want to leave the European Union or not? They've never had that chance. Neither has any other country, only Britain. And if these other countries, including France, Germany, had the opportunity to vote out of the European... I mean, I had a chance to talk to hundreds of people. In fact, there were thousands on the marches over in Germany.
Right.
Against the European Union. Even though the EU has done quite well for Germany, the German, ordinary German people are dead against it. I mean, they were literally, I mean, I saw two marches, right? This is when I was in Dresden for the Bilderberg. And there was a march with about 3,000-4,000 people in Dresden on a Monday evening, I think it was. Very peaceful, you know, but quite insistent, like Germans are, you know.
Right.
Very Protestant country. All part of this Pegida movement. Now, you know, some would say it's racist. Okay, there were some people that looked a bit thuggish who were like security guards for the Pegida leaders. But these were just genuine, ordinary German people that don't want to see their national culture destroyed by mass migration of cheap labour into their country. This is actually not far right. It's understandable. People want to retain their national identity. And what we're being told by the EU is that we're just going to ship cheap labour in from any part of the world, and once they're in the EU, they can move wherever they want within the United States of Europe, which they don't tell you it is, but that's what it really is.
Yeah, that's what it is, yeah.
There was another counter-demonstration, which was pro-European Union, which was a kind of left-wing demonstration, and it was something like a 50th of the size. There were probably about 30 people in it, and they were a kind of dishevelled bunch of mostly dressed in black anarchists, and they were, I mean, I tried to take a photo of this march, and the people were scared to even have their photo taken. You know, they were like covering their faces up and pointing and shouting, and they had this kind of grunge music they were playing. They looked like a bunch of no-hopers, to be honest. And that was the attitude that they had in Germany. Now, if even the country that the EU is benefiting the most is dead against it, you know, what hope is there for this institution? I think it's about time someone got out the golden stake or the silver stake or whatever it is,
right,
and bang it into the EU's heart.
Exactly.
Knock it out for good.
Well,
because it is only strangling ordinary Europeans in this horrible kind of strangulation of debt. That's all it's actually really doing, George, slowly but surely. And people must stand a better chance to have a local... I mean, what's happened to our parliament here in Britain is it's just become a talking shop. Since the European Union has begun making our laws, these people are only allowed to make laws within a certain, you know, narrow stricture. So it's ended the primacy and the sovereignty of parliament. Now, some people like that. They like concentration of power. Mostly they're totalitarians and dictators. And, of course, the European Commission that runs the whole EU is all these failed politicians, people who've been rejected by the voters, suddenly find themselves on this elevator to the very top of European power. It's an unbelievable system, and it's got to go.
Yes, it's not fair, and it's not democratic, and it's not elected or through elections or anything. It's bad.
There is one positive thing to say about all this.
No, and Bob Chapman said some things way back years ago. He said the European Union wouldn't stay together because of cultural and central banking issues. That's what he used to say. And language, of course, too. To some degree.
More simple than that. It's more simple than that. The reason it won't stay together is because it's a dictatorship. And
nobody wants it. They don't want the European Union Parliament telling them what to do.
One of the things that I'm quite heartened to see is that, very sensibly, the British government is staying in the European Court of Human Rights. I mean, we're signed up to this European Human Rights Treaty. So we're going to be staying on that. So what's happened is they're looking, you know, the government here has been quite sensible, the civil service, etc. They're looking through all these European institutions, and they're saying, well, this one's no good, goodbye, which includes, obviously, the European Commission, things like the European Parliament, and these MEPs, they have no lawmaking power. So what's the point in sending them there? So they say, no, we're not going to be doing that anymore. We're also pulling out of the European Court of Justice, which is it's actually no justice at all, really, because, of course, it's all fixed with fixed judges, etc., who are just doing what they're told. But last week, they had what I can only describe as the most ridiculous law I've ever seen, which was passed by the European Court, which said, this is actually a week before last, which says that if your employee is wearing a headscarf, which is actually what most women used to do in Britain in the 1960s, for example.
Right.
It was just the normal thing in Britain in those days. If you're wearing a headscarf, your employer can sack you with no notice whatsoever on the spot. Now, hang on a minute, because if you're a good worker who happens to be a Muslim and wants to wear a headscarf, that means totally discriminated against, and that is just totally wrong as regards employment law. You know, if you're going to sack someone just for wearing a headscarf, I mean, they've also come up with another mad law, which says that you can force women employees to wear high heels. You know, this just
sounds like a whole bunch of
rather pervy men running the show. It's what it sounds like to me. Like, if some woman comes into work and she doesn't want to, you know, let her hair down and look all sort of sexy and gorgeous, and she wants to put a headscarf on, we're going to boot her out the door. But if she wants to wear high heels, fine, that's great. In fact, we can force her to if we want to. So, you know, it's a totally hypocritical legal system, and it's actually quite dictatorial and fascistic, I think. And I think actually that's where we're going in the EU. We're going towards a police state. I mean, to a certain extent, we're going in that direction here too, with more arming of the police in London particularly. But the EU is definitely heading down that road. When you start to get loads of people, like we've got, you know, 500 million people going into debt in Europe more and more, what happens is you create the perfect kind of carpet for the next Adolf Hitler to come along. Because that's what the awful situation in Germany, you have to examine the past, otherwise you're going to repeat it. I mean, various people, Orwell, etc., have said this. If you don't learn from the past, you repeat it. And that is exactly why Hitler came to power back in the early 1930s, because Germany had an economic crisis. There was mass unemployment, exactly what's been going on in Italy and in Spain and in Greece. You know, so this is a perfect storm at waiting for the next fascist dictatorship to come along. And I think the European Union is absolutely culpable because there are no checks and balances. A good friend of mine worked in the European Parliament as a researcher for a Green member of the European Parliament from Ireland for many years. And he eventually gave up. And I said, well, why have you resigned? He said, well, it's because this machine will never work. It will never work for the people. It will only work for the people that actually designed the machine. And there's no democracy in it, so I'm just going to go off and use my engineering skills back over in Ireland. And that's exactly what they've done.
You know, Nigel Farage was very critical of the European Union, wasn't he?
Yes.
I mean, he hated the whole system, it looked like. He would speak out on the floor of the Parliament, you know.
Well, he's
is very good at just cutting to the chase, where you've got all these mealy-mouthed... I mean, there are thousands on the EU gravy train, that is to say, failed politicians, has-beens, that would never really get elected except for being on a party ticket of some sort, that enjoy their rather lavish lifestyle as EU members of the European Parliament, etc. And, I mean, I've seen them. When they get over to Brussels and Strasbourg, they're living in a kind of horrible kind of ivory tower bubble. You know, they're sealed off from the outside world. They've got their own kind of cutesy little bulletproof shopping centres they can wander around in. And there is no real contact with the outside world. It's almost as if the European Parliament was designed to have some kind of total kind of social breakdown going on outside, while all these MEPs are kind of sealed off from it in this cosseted little world where they're all kind of stroked and looked after by the money people. You know, that's just my impression of seeing the way that that it operates over there.
Yeah.
It's not real. It's a kind of fantasy world. It's made to look like it's some kind of, democratic bureaucracy, but as soon as you start to scratch...
Yeah, it looks so, like Hollywood. That's what they do. They invent things, make it look real.
Well, that's right, exactly. It does seem like a kind of Hollywood production. You're quite right. And also, you mentioning Hollywood, actually, the standard of the cultural output in the West has just plummeted over the last 30, 40 years, really since the 1990s mainly. The films, I mean, you know what, George, I go on YouTube and I will watch a film from the 1940s, which is 100 times better than anything that's coming out.
Yes, that's true. Some of them are good. Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, it's trash today. A lot of this stuff, you know, it's reflection of the culture. The culture's been debased.
I'll just give one concrete example. I was watching a film the other day called The Rossiter Case. It's an old British film. I think it's the late 40s, early 50s. And my goodness, it's absolutely gripping all the way. It's a bit like a Hitchcock type, you know.
Right.
But it's a real film. And it's about real people, real tensions. And it's a film that's, in a way, probably born of the kinds of experiences that people had during the Second World War, where they see just how wicked and cruel people can be and how you should look beyond the surface to see... motivating people in the world. And there was a tremendous kind of outpouring of that culture after World War II up until early 1990s, when it was absolutely squashed. We've also, by the way, had another conviction this week of a former BBC children's presenter as a paedophile. I'm not sure how far around the world that's gone, because the BBC have hardly reported it at all, only on their local news services down in the West Country, Devon, places like that.
Well, I've seen them when they want to bury something in America, the newspapers used to put it on the back page of the classified ad section.
But Channel 4, I think the guy's name was John Earle. He was a BBC children's television presenter.
Okay.
And he's now gone to jail, I think, for a long period of time, even though he's an old man now. We're talking about something like 50 years ago these offences took place. You know, it's good to see that the one brilliant thing that's come out of the whole BBC Jimmy Savile, Prince Charles, you know, Margaret Thatcher little circle down at Chequers that's come out is that the police in Britain now, at least in some of the forces, are taking this whole thing much more seriously. And so there is a real understanding that paedophilia, child abuse, child sexual abuse, particularly of underage children, you know, and even prepubescent kids, has been going on sanctioned right from the top for decades here in Britain, and that this is something that the police are prepared to nail. It remains to be seen whether there will be prosecutions of Conservative MPs for election fraud, because this has dragged on for the last 2 years. But, you know, we are, I suppose, crossing our fingers and hoping for the best that the British police will do as they're supposed to do and hold everybody as equal under the law. Now, it would be nice if they did the same with the royal family, because the royal family really do think they're above the law. In fact, they are, because anyone that's being prosecuted for a crime in Britain is prosecuted by the Crown Prosecution Service, that is, by the Queen. So it's a bit difficult to imagine the Queen being prosecuted by our own Crown Prosecution Service.
Right.
So, you know, that's one of the weird things of the British constitution is that the royal family really do seem to be above the law. But I mean, I think what we're doing is we're heading, at least we're attempting to head out of the EU. We're sending a signal to all the other people right across Europe. Yes, you can leave this monstrosity and you can get back your own cultural identity. I don't think anybody wants to, you know, have a go at people who are migrants from other parts of Europe here in Britain, but they do have to understand that unless they have proper full British citizenship, they may not be able to stay here. You know, they may be able to stay, and I think, you know, what will happen is the British government will look at each person case by case. You know, if there is a good reason for them to stay in the country, say for example they married someone here, then they'll almost certainly be able to stay. If they're, you know, their role is required, their skills are required here, they probably will. But you cannot come to a country under a work permit or a work visa and expect to be able to stay there forever.
Right. When I was over in London in 2006, a lot of the people were from Poland. I ran into a lot of the people, you know, running restaurants and waiting in tables and stuff. I seemed to, you know, run into a lot in Westminster area, you know.
Yeah, you will. You find, yeah, I mean, there's lots from the whole of Eastern Europe.
Right.
But, you know, nobody is against these people. In fact, I was on a debate tonight where somebody was talking about, oh, well, this whole Brexit thing is inspired by the far right. Absolute rubbish. Look, the European Union is supporting the far right in Kiev, in Ukraine. There is an absolutely, I mean, they're not neo-Nazis, they are Nazis. Many of the people who are running the Kiev government, particularly in the military side, are not. They are being supported by the EU and the United States, with US troops and NATO troops now going in to help train these neo-Nazis to try and take back the Russian-speaking parts of Ukraine. So don't tell me that the EU is somehow anti-fascist. It's not. It's quietly, happily dealing with fascists in Eastern Europe because that is what they do, and supporting them and funding them and even arming them. You know, so the real reaction here in Britain against the EU is mainly driven by the lack of jobs. The fact that people are coming in, you know, with the same skills to do the jobs in Britain for much less than British people can afford to. It's a very expensive place to live here. And yes, you know, it may be that they're harder working or whatever, but at the end of the day, every country has got a right to keep its own cultural identity. And I think that's what many people right across Europe are saying. Well, we're starting to lose that. And at the end of the day, you know, what you've done is you've tried to dissolve our country into some sort of big United States of Europe. They've had enough. And I think there is going to be a bit of a confrontation, and I think Britain is going to basically have to take it on the jaw
right.
of the EU. We're going to get a real hard time here, and you know, Britain is going to be used as a sort of collective punishment, you know, like the Nazis.
Yeah, they're going to put you on the rack and try to, you know, make it hurt.
As an example, yeah there will be an attempt at collective. That's the way these people think. They're control freaks.
Yeah, that's right. They are. Well, that's some really good insights, Tony.
And I hope so, George. Yeah, I mean, I'm just trying to give you my take.
Right.
Some of this stuff. And, you know, if you really want to get into the EU, people want to really understand it. We're not getting any of this on our mainstream press. The origins of it are probably even before this, but are certainly there in 1942. The Nazis wanted this kind of arrangement. There were even plans published in under Quisling in Norway for a German model of a cartel-run fascist Europe. Fortress Europe, they called it, and that's what they wanted. And, you know, if the EU is allowed to continue like it is, that's what they'll get. And Britain is saying, no, we're not having that fascist Fortress Europe controlled by these massive multinational cartels, which are backed by people like the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds.
Right. I'll tell you, that big money power has been ruining us to the world. It really has. And so forth.
Anyway, George, I hope that's
Boy, okay. That's great. Boy, Tony, thank you for the insight, and we appreciate you reporting in from Bristol, and you really got some really good things to say.
And we didn't even talk about the EU army, did we?
No, not yet. We'll do that next week. Okay.
Hey, God bless, George. Thank you.
God bless you too. Good night. Bye bye.